That's it, man. Starting right now, me and you are going to be free and happy the rest of our lives.
I'm not happy. I'm miserable.
What? What?
See, I grew up idolizing guys like Fonzie and Vinnie Barbarino because they got a lot of chicks. You know what happened to Fonzie and Vinnie Barbarino?
Yeah, I read like Fonzie wants to be a director and Barbarino, I think, the Mechanical Bull movie? I didn't see it yet.
Their shows got canceled. Because nobody wants to see a 50-year-old guy hitting on chicks.
So what are you saying?
What I'm saying is, all I really want is someone to hold me and tell me that everything is going to be all right. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator in this journey through the vast cinematic works of one Adam Sandler, Mr. Sejan Serowik. Sejan, how are you tonight?
I'm excellent tonight, Devin. I let me say this. I am ready, prepared, and wide awake, because I don't know if you're aware of the intoxicating aroma of Obsession by Calvin Klein that was so popular in the 80s that I ordered an entire bottle of, and when it arrived, it was it was rather broken in the box because it was 30 years old at this point. Also, I don't know if perfume goes rancid, I believe would be the right word for it, but if it does, this bottle did, and it is everywhere. I ordered too much of it, and it has gone all over.
Excellent. Most excellent. I have to admit, I wasn't expecting the Obsession to branch and bridge over into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. So, thanks for that.
Washed my hair in pert so that it's nice and all my curls are there. I've got the thickest tie I own on with the thickest knot I could tie in it. Yeah, man, I'm good to go for this one.
I'm drinking the new Coke. Personally, how I'm celebrating.
And I looked for Crystal Pepsi, but even that was a little bridge too far, I think.
Crystal Pepsi was a 90s reference, so I think you just lost 80s reference chicken. No offense, my friend.
But I mean, it has to happen eventually, because nobody's gonna beat the Wedding Singer 80s reference chicken. I mean,
that's very true. Though I am happy to report that this shirt was washed in all temperature. So
I thought you were gonna say in the 80s. No, but what is this, Downey?
Welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I don't want to mince words. I love this movie. I'm gonna just be honest. I loved this movie. And that's even more awkward because I haven't seen The Wedding Singer since I saw it in theaters in 1998. This is not a movie that I have rewatched since we got here in our journey into the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. So I'm thankful for our theme of Adam and in our first two leaps into the universe. We looked at Adam and Jennifer Aniston in Just Go With It and Murder Mystery. And those episodes are still out there, still available if you want to see where they fit into the cinematic universe, if they even do, and what we felt about them. But now we're getting to the real meat and potatoes of the Adam and storyline. And that is by exploring the films of Adam and Drew Barrymore.
Alan Covert. Oh, right. Yeah, Drew Barrymore. Right. Alan. Yeah. Yep. Sorry. Adam and Drew Barrymore. You're right. No, man. I am right there with you. So yeah, first impressions. Like, I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it, because I would say that the word that I would use for this, and I may have used this for other ones of his movies in the past, but this is the first time where it really feels like it's like sticking out to me like a blinding like neon light. is delightful. This movie is just delightful. Like, it's one of those, it's charming as hell, and, you know, part of that is not, you know, we're going to get into Sandler in this movie, because we're going to have to talk about some stuff that he decides to do in this movie that I think is for the better for both himself and his career. But on top of that, we're gonna talk a lot about Drew Barrymore over the coming months, so I don't want to hide this. Like, she is one of my favorite on-screen personalities, no matter what movie she's in, no matter what age she is, no matter what she's doing. From everything from E.T. to Charlie's Angels to Grey Gardens, like, she is she is one of those people that always draws me in, if only for the fact that she is always extremely earnest and not missing at all from this movie. She is so honest in this film in her character, and the fun that she is clearly having on screen is just it's enchanting, and like, and it brings you right in. Like, so like, let's get that off the table now. If you came here expecting us to crap all over this movie from at this point 23 years ago,
yeah, almost exactly.
It's not gonna happen, because we're gonna gush over this film, guys, because like I can't help it. I have seen it a lot more often than that. The Wedding Singer was one of those rare bad boys of comedy films, as we've talked in the past about Sandler being one of those, Jim Carrey being up there as well and stuff like that, where my mom and dad actually got really into it. They did not buy into the bad boy of comedy style film, Will Ferrell, that sort of stuff. It's not their jam. But this was one of those rare ones that I don't know why they decided to see it, but they rented it one weekend from the major video at the time, which eventually became the Blockbuster. And then like it became one of those ones where every so often they'd rent again. And to the point where I think eventually somebody probably bought it for them, because I seem to remember the box, the VHS box, being on our shelf eventually. I wouldn't call it a staple in our house. You know, I've talked frequently about like the Sunday afternoon movies that we would always watch no matter where they were, or if it was on TV, we'd definitely put it on. But it was definitely one of those ones where if my family got in the mood for a good romantic comedy, like this would have been up there in the top five for them to watch.
I get that. A lot of our top five romantic comedies feature Nicolas Cage and Charlie Sheen. So if you want to glance into the world of the Deckers in terms of top five, you know, romantic comedies, this one never really scratched the surface. That
can't
said,
argue with Peggy Sue Got Married. You know, I'm going to put that out there. Like, I'm right there with you guys.
More It Could Happen to You. My father loves that. Okay. And The Chase. But we've talked about that on the Say Report, our other podcast. This film, though, after rewatching it for the first time, because I watch it multiple times when we're doing the show. I want to make sure that I've kind of drained every bit of life out of it in order to inject it into the episode. I did a little TED talk for the family saying that it's just a delight and that I really like The Wedding Singer. Mm-hmm. And neither of my parents could disagree with that. That said, it always seemed like a movie that everyone else around me enjoyed a lot more than I did. And, I mean, for better or for ill, it's not that I was a contrarian. It's not like I'm not going to like The Wedding Singer. But people would bring up The Wedding Singer, and I'd be like, oh, I really, it's a good movie. I enjoyed it. And then they would proceed to launch into, like, scenes and sequences from it. And honestly, I did not have any memory for that with The Wedding Singer.
I can solve this mystery for you right here, right now. Do you know what it is? This is the Adam Sandler movie that people were allowed to like. Mm-hmm. We talk very frequently about the zeitgeist eventually kind of grabbing everybody and even us to a point where like you felt like you couldn't admit that you wanted to see the new Adam Sandler movie, that sort of thing. And I think that's what this movie became, is it became the release. It became that little release valve of steam that you could let out kind of that pressure so that you could hide your love for Sandler for the next 10 years, that sort of thing. Is if somebody brought up The Wedding Singer, you were allowed to talk about why that was the good one. And so I think that it's a lot of people, for lack of a better term, becoming defensive about this movie, because I think there's a lot of really good stuff in here that a lot of people really latch onto, my parents included, me included, people included, that are present in other Sandler films. And we're going to, I mean, that's what the whole episode's about today, so I don't want to like spoil anything. But the idea being that like, I don't think that there's anything too crazy new in here for what we have talked about here on the show, but for anybody out there that is not the Sandler fans that we clearly are, for the people out there that are not watching all of his movies with a critical lens, like this, there would be stuff in this movie that you'd be like, oh, I love that happened. And you're like, yeah, that happens all the time in his movie. It's fine. It's fine. Mom. It's good. Like, you know what I mean? Like legitimately. So the reason why it feels like everybody kind of launches into that is because this is the movie where everybody can kind of start that conversation. And with that, I love the idea that we may have found a movie that I'm not going to declare it part of the universe, but I'm at least going to declare it like this is kind of the movie where if you were going to get somebody to kind of get in on this journey with you, Sandler fans out there that aren't sure how to tell your wives, tell your loved ones, like, this is what you're doing right now. Like, maybe start with The Wedding Singer, right? Like that, like that's going to be my thing. This is his most commercially acceptable film kind of to this day. We'll talk more about that later, but at least at the time, because this is 1998, so it's a couple of years after Happy Gilmore, so he's got a few movies under his belt and a couple of smaller roles under his belt. This isn't like the first time we've ever seen him on screen by any stretch, but it's before we kind of get to that weird like 2000s rut where like everybody's kind of quote unquote sick of Sandler. I think that's where this is all coming from, Dev.
Yeah. And to establish what it is that we're doing here, we are unabashedly Adam Sandler fans, Seijin and I, and when Hubie Halloween came out, people were like, oh, everybody's talking about Cinematic Universe, what do you guys think about that? And rather than, like, have to have that conversation with every other person who'd come up to me saying, have you seen the new Adam Sandler movie? What do you think? Is there a shared cinematic universe? We decided to jump into his entire filmography and determine what is and what isn't in our personal Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And this film, Seijin brings up a wonderful point that this is a great entry point if you're trying to like bring in outsiders. I mean, it's based in the 80s, and what is the 80s if not the most gateway of drugs for many many different things. But this is actually the first film that I watched during the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe experience where I was a little bit regretful of the fact that we decided to kind of jump around in this. And we'll get to why later on when we get to New Old Borrowed Blue. But this is an important film, and it's almost as if we did a disservice by not covering it until 9th. But then also, this episode is going to release the same week as Adam Sandler's birthday. So, like, it kind of works out, right?
Yeah, hey, man, this is our love letter to you. Let this episode be, if anything, a love letter to you. Also, I don't know if I've ever pointed it out before, but I do really love that the conclusion that we came to was, clearly there's a universe. Let's just establish the rules for it. It was never a question of, is there or isn't there? It was always, of course there is.
Right, and that really stems from a movie that's going to be talked about a lot today. Little Nicky, a movie that when I saw the reviews for it the first time, somebody said, this is the greatest hits of Adam Sandler films, so if you're not a fan of Adam Sandler, don't bother. And that greatest hits nature made Little Nicky a nexus point of a universe for myself. So,
and it became very jarring for a lot of people. You suddenly, you know what Little Nicky did, and I'm happy to take 2 seconds to rant about this now since we've already done an episode on it. I don't need to save it for later. But really, in thinking about it, and this movie kind of solidified this idea for me, is Little Nicky kind of drew a line in the sand. At that point, you were either in the Sandler Club or you weren't, and I think that might be why it might be his most divisive film and kind of the start of that feeling like, well, if you're not in the Adam Sandler Club, then it's your job to shit all over him. But right now, right here, this is a movie 2 years before that, and so my mom was quite allowed to sit back and watch an Adam Sandler movie and enjoy it.
Everybody was. Everybody was because it wasn't a pro-Adam, anti-Adam world yet.
It was
a world where Adam Sandler just existed, and shots had not really been fired yet.
Also, Drew Barrymore was at this time just, and hey, as far as I'm concerned, still is America's darling, right?
Like, she's like, America's sweetheart.
The casting there, wherever that comes from, because God knows what goes behind the scenes of these movies, and this is very much a Sandler production, unlike, say, Just Go With It that we've talked about in the past. Where the decision came along for this casting, I don't know, but I want to buy that person a bottle of champagne, because the two of them on screen together.
I don't think she drinks, but by all accounts, Drew Barrymore is the reason Drew Barrymore is in this movie.
Fair enough, then. I will buy her some Martinellis, and we'll split a bottle of apple cider. But to that, Dev, where are we in the formula here? Remind me again.
So what I would like to do, I was going to pause for station identification. If you enjoy what we do with the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we have a weekly podcast called The Say Report, and that covers everything, every single topic. Nothing is off limits on that show. So if you like our hyper-focused Adam Sandler, you might like us just a little bit more loosey-goosey and just kind of talking about anything that caught our eye over the past week. And at that point, do you have any facts and figures on The Wedding Singer that you're able to provide? How did this film do? How did
actually,
it fare?
Quite well. So it only has one real enemy when it comes out. First of all, I want to applaud something. This is... We talk about a lot about Sandler and his company knowing really well, like, how to work the movie industry really well, both in getting people in their movies, how to make movies. But this is one of those beautiful, beautiful opportunities for me to talk about the idea that they also had a very good handle on the marketing of their films. They kind of knew exactly what they were doing, because this movie comes out on February 13th of 1998. How perfect is that? It is a movie, like, it becomes the date movie, and that is in the same year, 1 week after Titanic.
Oof.
So Titanic is out. You say oof, but this movie makes its budget back for day, like weekend one. Like, it's a small movie, $18 million, which is, yeah, nothing to laugh at, you know, 1998, got to keep that in mind, but it makes over that in its first weekend. So Titanic is number one from the week before, still number one, and as we know, is going to go on to make millions and then eventually billions, right? Like, that's just the way that monster lives, right? To that, though, The Wedding Singer puts up a heck of a show. And by the time all is said and done worldwide, it makes back more than 150% of its budget. So, like, it's fine. Like, the movie is a hit. As we talked about before, like, his first kind of real flop, I think, comes along with Little Nicky. Where was it? Might have been Waterboy, which is the movie right after this for him. But those flops, they're not coming yet. This is still on the roll from Billy Madison, then Happy Gilmore, then this. So, like, the movie does phenomenally. And going up against Titanic is, like, I mean, it's David taking on Goliath. A feat really only accomplished by Cameron taking on himself with Avatar. So, I mean, like we cannot hold Sandler to that financial standard, right? And
this
won't.
Is not another action movie. It's not a sweeping, epic, three-hour-long film. This is honestly an amateur production taking on something from the Juilliard school.
Well, and more beautifully is, again, all credit where credit's due, the ways in which they figure out how to pick up kind of the slack, anybody that's falling through the cracks of Titanic, because I, you know, and not that the hate watch culture was as big in the 90s as it is now, but anybody that says, like, I'm not going to that, I'm going to go do something else, then, like, going to the other romantic movie that weekend is The Wedding Singer, right? Like, and that's it's perfect. It's perfectly timed. It's a... just applause all around for the business side of everything with this film. So yeah, to that point, you know, it makes its money back. It does really, really well. It runs for a total of 46 weeks, but God knows what that means by the end of it. But yeah, I mean, like, PG-13 romantic comedy in the mid-90s, like, and it doesn't make enough waves to, like, blow anybody's mind in terms of, like, awards or anything like that, but it does hit just hard enough that, as you mentioned earlier, Dev, people can't shut up about it.
Yeah, that is a true, almost unfortunate thing. It's one of those situations where people can't stop talking about The Wedding Singer, and if I were a weaker person, it might have turned me off to the film. Because of the fact, like, you talk about it being, like, queued up to go against Titanic and all that. That really speaks to the sort of entry-level feeling that this film has when you consider the fact that it has to be the type of movie that the guy who, like, saw Billy Madison and has the Happy Gilmore shirt is going to say to his significant other, hey, why don't we go see The Wedding Singer for Valentine's Day? And, like, and she has to not say to him, we're getting a divorce. has to not say, we're done. She has to say, oh, that looks cute. And Drew Barrymore.
Give me one more. You got one more?
That's about it. That's
she has to say, like, maybe he hasn't been wrong about Sandler this whole time, and then the next year they go to the water boy and then they hate their husbands. So the other thing that we should mention about this film, just in keeping with kind of the fiction, the real world fiction of the Sandler verse, right? This is also the first Sandler movie that we see one of our favorite directors, Frank Coraci.
Frank Coraci.
Coraci, thank you. Mm-hmm. Frank Coraci jumps on. This is, you know, and writer wise, it's
Tim Herlihy.
Tim Herlihy, dang, firing all cylinders tonight, who has been around since Billy Madison,
yep.
Shows up in the movie and everything. It's a Sandler production all around. Like, this is fully in their wheelhouse. I kind of hinted at it earlier, and we're going to definitely talk more about it later, but also probably the beefiest role for Alan Colvert in the Sandler repertoire.
Definitely. And I love Alan Colvert. If it weren't for Adam Sandler being in these films, this would be the Alan Colvert cinematic universe.
It's a shame that he takes so much more of a back seat going forward, like, because he, you know, he does his thing where he shows up on screen for a few minutes all the time, and we love him for it. But I was like, you know, I was not prepared when he first showed up in that first scene. I was thinking it was going to be the covert like role, right? And no, like, he's the best bud. Like, he is in the romantic comedy formula. Like, he is quintessential of this film, and it's amazing. He's great.
He's the second lead, really. Well, no, the second lead is he's the second male lead. That's what you would say. That's how you would say it. not the heel. The heel is Glenn Gulia, and he's in the film far less than Alan Colvert. Matt Shane, is that his name? Crazy name. Matt Glaive, that's his name. Matthew Glaive. What a weird name. I love that name. I love Matthew Glaive. And I also need to give credit to Matthew Glaive, because having only seen this movie the one time, I was fairly certain that it was just Shooter McGavin playing a different character in this movie.
No, man. And anybody that wants to see one of the sexiest, newer IMDb photos, he looks like he fits in with the Rat Pack in his IMDb photo, but it was clearly taken within the last, like, 10 years. Matthew Glaive. Check that out.
Matthew Glaive. Good guy. I want to give Matthew Glaive credit. And
before we shit all over him.
Because he's a terrible... His character is awful. Definitely in the league of evil Sandler villains, assuming this film is part of the universe, which I like that. Who knows, right? Siegen started that. And there's just one other thing that I need to say before we move on to the next segment. And that is, in 2011, so 10 years ago, I was lost. Personally, I was a lost person. And I thought, maybe I want to try acting. So I tried out for a local production of the Wedding Singer musical.
Yes.
And this is literally the only time that the Wedding Singer musical is going to be brought up in this episode from my end. This is it for me. And I don't know what Siegen has, so I don't want to put it on him. But this is going to be about the movie. But, you know, personal timeline, it speaks to maybe why I didn't revisit this movie, at least maybe over the last 10 years. And that's because... on this audition, very first audition for anything, in front of people who don't know me. This is like strangers. I go out to audition for a show, and I get cast as Sammy. I get cast as the Alan Colvert character. And unfortunately, due to, let's call it, intellectual differences, because it wasn't a creative issue, I got into a fight with the stage manager. I was fired from the show.
Okay.
After 1 week of rehearsals. And that's why you don't yell at the stage manager, because maybe their mother's a producer on the show, and you just don't know that.
Zoops. No, I mean, it's, in terms of the show, like, it's a above par jukebox musical. Originally, the role when it first premieres is played by Stephen Lynch.
Yeah,
so like you know, it's one of those ones where, like, I put it on the same level as, like, a Footloose or a Xanadu. Like, if you get the chance to see a live showing of it, it's a good time. It's a fun night. Just make sure that there are drinks that you can bring into the theater. That's all.
Yeah. It's very emblematic of the 2006 craze of every movie is worthy of being turned into a musical.
Yeah.
Is the best way to put it. I mean, thanks, The Producers, which The Producers, fantastic. If you get the chance, see The Producers. But not everything. For every Producers, there's a High Fidelity. And The Wedding Singer falls somewhere in between those. It's just one of those things. So it was interesting, again, looking at this as a thing that I kind of wanted nothing to do with The Wedding Singer after that negative experience in my life 10 years ago.
Puts a bad taste in your mouth. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. But if that hadn't happened, right, and I went on to become some big local musical guy, I doubt I'd be podcasting, and I doubt I'd be doing the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe right now with Seijin. And then, like, one step beyond, because of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, I get to go back and re-celebrate this film. So The Wedding Singer, it's important to my own personal, not even related to this podcast, cinematic universe and its relationship to Adam Sandler. So I want to let that bias be known as we go forward into the episode. And with that, I think it's time for me to give the synopsis of this particular film. Are you ready, CJ?
Let's hear it. Yeah, man. So then we can get to the meat and potatoes.
Robert J. Hart has owned one thing in his life since his parents died when he was in third grade, to be married and start a family of his own. Sure, he's had other dreams along the way, like being a songwriter, but once he started singing at weddings to make some extra money along the way, he realized that not only did it allow him to perform, but also to help people. The best part, even as just a wedding singer, he still found a woman who loves him, and they are getting married in a week. The same can't be said for Julia Sullivan, who has just moved to town to be closer to her fiancé, Glengulia, and has gotten a job at the wedding reception hall that Robbie performs at. Julia's been dating Glenn for 4 years, and the past two, they've been engaged, but she's beginning to fear that despite this commitment, Glenn is never going to set a date. When it comes time for Robbie to be married, Linda, his fiancé, doesn't show. When he later confronts her about her absence, she confesses she doesn't want to be married to a man who sings at weddings. She'd rather be married to the rock star she thought that Robbie was going to be. And since he doesn't even seem to have the ambition to move out of his sister's basement, let alone to move away from his childhood town of Ridgefield, she leaves him, sending him down a deep depression. A broken heart is the worst ailment for a person who regularly performs at celebrations of love, and when a brawl breaks out at his first performance after his failed nuptials, Robbie decides that it is time for him to quit performing at weddings altogether. Meanwhile, Glenn, who'd prefer a Vegas wedding, has foisted all of the wedding planning responsibilities onto Julia. When she thanks Robbie for his recommendation of a florist, she realizes that the perfect person to help her with this overwhelming task is the one who has spent most of his professional career around such events. Robbie protests, saying he no longer that person, but ultimately reluctantly agrees to assist Julia with this task. A strong friendship blossoms between the two, and with only a week until the wedding, Robbie realizes that he has begun to fall in love with Julia, an exacerbated fact when Glenn, his only hurdle, admits to his face that he cheats on her. To even further complicate matters, Julia has also realized that it may actually be Robbie that she is in love with. Life gets in the way when each of them attempts to confess their feelings to the other, leading Julia to hop a flight to Vegas to just get married to Glenn over with. But with a little nudge from fate, these two might finally connect and share their truths in order to grow old together.
No, yeah, man. It's really interesting to me because for all of the really tropey feelings that you have in this movie, you know the shitty boyfriend, the fun best friend who is also in this case the sister, but she's great as
she's
like,
a
the
cousin
best
the important thing is that Holly Sullivan is her cousin, so she seems like a sister literally everywhere but when Alan Covert says she's Holly's cousin.
Yeah. But they, you know, they live together, right? And all that sort of stuff. Like there's that, right? And then there's Alan Covert, as we mentioned, as the kind of the fun, like, second male lead as the best friend. There's all that sort of silly stuff that happens in this movie. That being said, there's not really like a particular thing I can point to that is like stolen in any way, you know? Like we've talked about in the past, there being direct lines between like Billy Madison and Back to School and things like that, right? Like there really isn't anything like that with this movie that I could find of. What, I don't know about you.
I mean, are we just going to jump into New, Old, Borrowed, Blue? Because that sounds like we're... Yeah, so we'll start with Borrowed. Very rarely we do this. Something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue, appropriate and inspired by The Wedding Singer in some small way, right? With weddings being on our minds when we think of Adam Sandler. Mm-hmm. And starting with The Borrowed, really the closest thing that I could think of in terms of borrowed from Hollywood is the end of this feels very The Graduate.
Sure. Yeah, I can definitely give you that. I was thinking specifically getting on the getting in the car and driving to the wedding in order to call it off, right? But then they don't get to the wedding. Then it's a whole other different thing.
yeah.
But, you know, so, yeah. But, yeah, so that's what I mean. Is like it gives you that kind of that hint that they've seen that movie. They've seen The Graduate for sure. But they don't go full on into, like, recreating the end of The Graduate. Unlike Wayne's World 2, which I think was out maybe just a year or two previously, where they literally redo.
Where they literally lift the ending of The Graduate. Yes. Yeah. So it's one of those situations, though, where, like, jumping into the New Old Borrowed Blue, I think it's important when we talk about this film not really feeling that, because what this borrows from more, as opposed to cinematic history, is just history in general.
80s history, and I would say music. That was the other big thing that I got in terms of, like, borrowed, like 80s culture. Point blank, and it's hard to avoid it because of the man this movie wants to remind you it's the 80s any friggin' second. You know the hell they make those jokes about period movies, how they always have to, like, in every scene remind you what year it is with some stupid reference that feels like out of script, like out of touch. This movie is the king of that. Like the best example I have is that moment when Holly is doing the stupid Rubik's cube and throws it across the room. Like what is... It was unnecessary for her to be doing that. Yeah, man, the number of nonsense 80s specific references just to remind you they're in the 80s was a little on the nose, shall we say.
Right. But also not just the popular culture stuff, but also there's that scene where they're at the photographer and she's like, "You're such a good couple. You're like Donald and Ivana," which is former President Donald Trump and Ivanka's mom, Ivana. Bert and Lonnie. So Bert Reynolds, and I can't think of Lonnie's last name right now. It has escaped me.
Reynolds, that would have been a safe one to say.
No, she's known as Lonnie Anderson. What? I don't know why I couldn't think of the Anderson. So that whole thing. And then the final one is Woody and Mia. And that ended famously swimmingly. While that's lifting from culture, right, it is one of those moments where, like, it weirdly grounds this film in our own reality.
For sure. Yeah, no, the grounding work in this movie is something else. It's really interesting because this movie treats the 80s as a fantasy world, but it did happen. Right. So like you're saying, they make all these references to things that you're like, well, yeah, right. Real world. And then like to that point, like the costuming and I wrote down the hair work in this film is just phenomenal. I don't know who the hairdresser was on this movie, but they should have won the Oscar that year. Like it's perfectly done. But on top of that, the 80s was just wild. Right. So there's also this very weird like fantasy reality is the way that I think it's best referred to of this entire movie, but at the same time they don't do anything that didn't actually happen.
Yeah, and that's it's the strangest part about it. And then I said I wasn't
purposely
going
so,
to.
I will say
yeah,
so,
it, I think
right?
it's definitely
like,
purposely
like
so.
They pick the 80s on purpose. Like there's a reason why they set this movie, and weirdly not like 10 years previously, but very specifically 1985. So they are hitting that sweet spot of mid 80s. So they can reference stuff early 80s damn, they can reference stuff late 80s and nobody's really going to question it. So they just kind of just hit the 80s to see, like, it's I Love the 80s before I Love the 80s came on VH1.
Right. It's probably the pilot for I Love the 80s. When you go into the pitch meeting, you've seen The Wedding Singer? That's what we're going to do. But
that
year by
Patton
year.
Oswalt showed up in Drew Barrymore's kitchen just shitting on people. Never mind.
I mean, like a Rubik's Cube? Really? We're just going to rip the stickers off. But yeah, it's strange. And 85 is also an interesting year because you have one of those. I mean, it's not necessarily borrowed, but it's a big one. Back to the Future says 1985 so many times that, like, if you're going to time travel, 1985 is an iconic year to people's ears in a cinematic space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Plus, it allows them to have that DeLorean later. And as I wrote, worst use of a DeLorean in film. Fuck that guy.
I mean, well, like, we go forward and we say that Adam Sandler likes to just travel with his buddies. That really just feels like I'd really like to drive a DeLorean. Can we get a DeLorean on set? And can I drive it? Like, not in the movie, but just like for funs?
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, so the 80s is the big thing that I will say borrowed. And the other thing that I want to point out, because I don't know any other time to talk about him, but I feel like I really want to, is Carmen Philpy. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No idea.
Okay. Carmen Philpy is the guy that later on in the movie has a phenomenal unnamed role other than old man in bar. He is the old dude that shows up towards the third act, kind of like the second act into third act transition of this movie. And he goes out for a night drinking with Robbie and Sammy. And he is phenomenal. And he's one of these dudes that shows up kind of in everything, did for years after this, for like another decade or so, still like did this kind of thing where he would just show up as like the comic relief in a moment. And before this, like in like the 80s, 70s, 60s, because the dude had been working since, you know, Noah. But the guy is like he was on Beverly Hillbillies, showed up in Gunsmoke. Like the guy has just been working always. And so it was really funny because he shows up and I'm just like, oh, man, gotta love it. Gotta love a casting of a good extra because I love this guy and everything that he shows up in. And then, like, weirdly becomes, like, part of the story for about 20 minutes. Like, Sammy and him, Alan Covert and this dude end up having an entire other, like, plot for about 20 minutes of this movie. And moments towards the end when he gets into the fight with I keep wanting to call him Gavin because it's not because I keep thinking Shooter McGavin, but it's not Gavin.
He's worse than Shooter McGavin. It is Glenn Gulia.
Glenn Gulia, yeah, because he's gonna be Julia Gulia. Glenn Gulia. But he when he punches Glenn Gulia, he goes, "I used to be stronger." I lost my shit at that moment. But he's a guy that has worked forever. So there's this that wants to believe that Sandler's love of film, while it doesn't come through in specific movies in this movie, the ways in which he incorporates just tropes from old movies on the 80s and everything that we love about that. Like, we joked about the DeLorean showing up, but it does actually show up in this movie, right? And all that. He seems like kind of the prime example of like of Sandler and his crew, like, and their love of old Hollywood kind of coming into this movie. And they can't avoid it. In a movie in which they focus so much more on the culture of the 80s, and as I said, the music of the 80s, which is just all over the place, like in this movie, that is one of the rare moments where I think you can see specifically film and television kind of coming into it.
And I just thought that's a good point. I think television, this is really the first Adam Sandler film that has a focus more in its references being related to television, with him calling Julia sort of like the Incredible Hulk. Yeah. Referencing the Bill Bixby, Lou Ferrigno show, the fact that the whole character of Glenn Gulia is based on Don Johnson from Miami Vice because
well,
he's a
John
fan.
Johnson meets Biff. He's yeah. Don Johnson meets Biff, which is like the amount of Back to the Future in this movie I am only really now coming to terms with. And I'm so happy that you pointed it out.
Yeah. He's essentially Biff if Biff got to watch Miami Vice.
Yeah.
And that's a big part. But then the best one is when Robbie is coming to watch the kids and his sister is all, "Come on, it's time to go." And he's like, "I'm watching Dallas. I think JR is dead. They shot him or something." Like, that is so... Who shot JR is such a moment in the 80s. Such a moment in the 80s that we recreated it in the 90s with Who Shot Mr. Burns, right?
And then we recreated it again with Who Shot JR again.
Yeah.
In the 2020s. Oh, man. Interesting little tidbit about the fact that they mentioned Dallas as a period marker for this movie to kind of give everybody kind of an idea of exactly where 97 eventually comes out in 98, but like with the people making this movie in the late 90s, where they're kind of at, Christine Taylor, her first acting role is on Dallas.
Yeah.
So she ends up in this movie, and they make jokes about Dallas as if that dates the movie, which is honestly only about 10 years previously, to the point where there are actors in this movie that were on these things and involved in these things in the 80s. So that's the other weird thing for me, is I'm watching it and like, oh, it's the 80s, and here we are in 2020, and I'm just like, whoa, that was 40 years ago. But then, like, actually... for the people making this film, it was not even really a decade for some of them. Like,
dude, and here's the most important thing. They avoid the cardinal sin. They avoid the cardinal sin of having Robbie make some sort of comment about that little girl in E.T. Right? Because it's right there in front of you, but it is the kind of comment that would invalidate everything in the film. It's that step too far. It's the uncanny valley that you would be unable to cross.
For
it would ruin the immersion. Yeah. And this film is all about immersion. And you really need to applaud a comedy with that kind of restraint.
When I was a kid, I was a real fire starter. They definitely, yeah. So to that point, right, like talking about Drew Barrymore in this film and the fact that, like, you know, the late 80s was her time to shine as a child actor. And like, and here we are talking about the 80s as if it's this mystical fantasy land that we could never, like, we could never truly understand.
Which this seems like a good time to transition over to the new. Mm-hmm. Which, again, I'm going to lead off on this, and then you can go first on Old and Blue. What this film is, this is the first period piece that we see Adam Sandler in.
Okay.
And that's weirdly important. Not just because it's kind of the only period piece, that it's certainly the only period piece that we've seen Adam Sandler in up to this point, but it's kind of... as far as I can recall in my memory, if there's some other big glaring one, you'll let me know right now. It's kind of the only time that they experimented with doing a period piece.
I will say that it depends on what your definition of period piece is. And I'm sorry to be an asshole about that.
No,
I'll
that's
explain
fine.
Myself. Like, is period specific is more what happens later on in movies for him. And specifically, the one that I'm thinking about is the one that he does about 9/11 that I can't think of the name of right now. I have his IMDb up in front of me, though, so give me a second. Rain Over Me. Thank you. He will eventually go on to do a movie like that, which is, like, I mean, undeniably period. Like, it's important, the period in which that movie takes place. So now looking back on it, it becomes one, right? That being said, the rest of it is all pretty up in the air. I mean, I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry is a pretty important piece in terms of period, just because of the ways in which gay marriage is experienced in the 2000s, right? Like, that sort of thing. So, like, you could talk about that. You could talk about, I don't know, like, there's a lot of, like, you can bend the rules on that, I guess, is what I'm talking about. The only other major one I would point out, and I don't want to, but I have to, is Ridiculous Six. But other than that, all cards off the table. This is the one that we really see him looking back on a time period and having a real investment in, is the other thing I will say, is that while the 9/11 piece becomes really important for anybody and everybody around that time, and Ridiculous Six is funny, but he wasn't alive during then. So, right. Like, this is the biggest thing about this particular period is this is a movie. This movie is a love letter to the 80s.
Mm hmm. I think it's interesting because you talk about it. It depends on what you categorize a period piece as. So, like, Ridiculous Six, definitely. It's set in the Old West, right? But you could also say that it's a genre film in terms of it being a Western, right?
Right.
It's more
right.
recreating that. But then you mentioned Rain Over Me and I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, which are now both period pieces in 2021, right?
Right.
Movies
right.
that you look back at and they really sort of captured what was going on in the world at the time. Where, for me, a period piece is we're going to try to recreate this period in time in our film, right?
Yeah.
You want to feel like you're living in the 80s during this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's, it's an important distinction. I'm glad that you bring that up. But I think what's really interesting is they do this film, which is, by all accounts, that second version of a period piece where we're going to recreate the feel of this universe, right? And specifically with some fantasy elements, because they are highlighting all of the better parts of the 80s, right? You do this movie now in the 80s, Glenn Gulia, he's probably doing coke, right? and that's a distinction about the character. Another reason why he shouldn't be with Julia, who barely drinks. But at this point, it's just that he's kind of an asshole, right? In this time... He's a douchebag.
I do think that there would be like there'd be more going on in the ways in which we look back at the 80s, not least of which because, as I mentioned earlier, the way in which we kind of fell kind of back in love with the 80s and the 2000s, right? The way in which nostalgia is becoming. It's really interesting because this movie kind of really introduces this to a lot of people, I think. Like, I may be mistaken, but this feels like kind of the first time where we started to look back on the 80s and like. Fondly, right? Because we had our like our Wall Streets and stuff like that where we looked back at the 80s and we were just like, oh yeah, that's when everybody was an asshole and nobody cared about anybody, and we tricked ourselves in the 90s into thinking we did care about each other, and then we learned later that that was not the case either. But there's this is kind of the first time where we're looking back with that nostalgia lens in a really interesting way, and it kind of kicks off like, you know, this whole chain of events going forward. Remind me again, Dev, what's the year on Blast from the Past?
Blast from the Past is 1999.
Yeah, so it's a year later where we get that same nostalgia factor, but for like the idea of like old America, right? Like
for the
50s, the idea
specifically.
Of just, right. But then it becomes kind of this conversation of just the way we were and what that means is different to every single person. So clearly, like this movie is one that really loves the 80s.
And it's interesting because the other thing that I was going to say is that while it's the first period piece that we see in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, just in his whole filmography, right? This is the first time that he's really doing a film like that. It does kick off that 80s period pieces. And historically, it is 2 to 3 years too early for that. Because you look at the 70s... Yeah. That's when Happy Days is huge. That's when they're celebrating the 50s, right? So it is usually a 20-year gap before we're willing to look back with that nostalgia and sort of celebrate what was going on. And then you have a movie like Blast from the Past, right, to mention, you know, Brendan Fraser's another guy that we're big fans of. That film is taking the nostalgia that we're looking at the 70s and then looking at how they were nostalgic for the 50s, and it's sort of layers on layers on layers. So the fact that they're like, we're going to make a film that looks back at the 80s, when right now the 80s are kind of blasé, right? That's sort of what 10 years back in history is. We don't really think anything of it. It's just sort of a thing that's happened.
Well, and I think what it is it's the difference between looking back 20 years ago and saying, look at the way those people were, and looking back 10 years ago and saying, look at the way we were.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing. And I would also be remiss, and I'm sorry, I know that it's usually just the one new, but this is one of those situations where I was regretful that we've sort of jumped around, though I think it's given us a pretty firm foundation to build our cinematic universe on, in that this is the first Adam Sandler film with a female perspective. And we then go on to later see them in things like Murder Mystery and Just Go With It. Where Jennifer Aniston's character we talk about, she is just as much a character as Adam Sandler in those two films. And it's important. But this is the first time in an Adam Sandler film that there is a female voice.
And it's important to distinctly point out that it is a female voice, not necessarily a very progressive one in any strong way. I mean, the entire movie, like, I don't think there's a scene where it's her alone not talking about either Adam Sandler or Shooter McGavin Jr. there. I'm just going to keep calling him that, Ghoulia there. Right. So, like, there's something to be said that this movie has a habit of being progressive for its time. And unfortunately, that progressiveness does not hold up to the sniff test nowadays. That being said, I don't think it's necessarily like offensive to female characters in this movie. I don't think there's anybody that comes out looking like crap by the end of it, because now here we are 30 years out. But that being said, there's not much more going on with a lot of what goes on in her scenes, which is unfortunate.
Right. But historically on this film, the studio wanted all of those scenes that did not feature Adam Sandler to be removed from this film. And they, because it was him with people he had worked with before, were like, no, we're not going to do that. and that's important because to them, on the creative side, they're like, no, we need to see how she's approaching this, right? Yeah. This is a movie about a love story. It's not a movie about how he fell in love. It's how they both fell in love. And it's sort of what elevates it over the two that came before it. Right. And the other weird thing is that, like, this was going to be the 97 Adam Sandler film. Right. So he was going to be Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Wedding Singer in 97, and then The Waterboy in 98. And talking about the marketing again, they realized maybe we should put it closer to Valentine's Day. Maybe that'll give us a boost to this love story. And that's the only reason why we get two Adam Sandler films in 1998. Instead of one each year. And that's an important kind of distinction to think of this as that third film.
The only other new that I want to bring to the table, the one that I wrote down, is this is the first hint that we get of dramedy Sandler, which we end up seeing in a lot more of his work later on, as we mentioned, Reign of Fire, right? And
Reign of Fire is a very different movie with dragons and Christian Bale.
Dragons brought down the Twin Towers and we must destroy them. In later movies, we see him take on a lot more semi-dramatic roles, you know, eventually to full-on dramatic roles and stuff like Uncut Gems and things like that. This is, I think, the first hint we really get of it in his career. So this is the first time that we get to see him be a lot more grounded in the things that he does. When he does kind of go over the top with, like, the yelling at people and things like that, it is completely grounded and justified in what's happening in the moment. You know, it's not an entire movie of him doing funny voices to himself and things like that. It's really interesting that we really get to see him kind of put his work in for this movie in a way that he had not been, I think, allowed to yet. I think it's just cool to see that on kind of his third major outing with his own studio that he realizes he's going to take this heat and use it as an opportunity to really kind of start putting in some real, like, acting work.
Yeah. And especially I do want to celebrate that his rage is tempered in this film.
Yeah.
Right. Especially when you're coming off of Happy Gilmore and there are those moments where it feels like he's going to go into that Happy Gilmore rage.
Right.
And no, he acts like a normal human being. It's like, you're allowed to be angry. You're allowed to be angry when your fiance doesn't show up at the wedding and honestly wasn't going to tell anybody, right?
Yeah.
A little bit of investigation from his sister is the only way that they even find out that she left a note.
Right.
And then when she shows up and she's like, I can learn to love that stuff. No, like, get out of here. I'm mad at you for that. You can learn to live with me? That's not what I want in a partner. Get out of here. And take off my Van Halen t-shirt. It is. You're right. That temperament of that rage, that, like, that it's not just a funny thing, but it's part of a deeper character, really does talk to you. I mean, how he's been building characters all along in this series. They're all layered, right? Even though at face value, they look like just one thing.
Yeah, well, and, you know, and just to kind of just beat the drum that I was hitting earlier, like, I don't think that we're seeing anything in this movie that's too groundbreaking. So new was kind of hard for me, right? Like pointing out this idea of Dramedy Sandler and the stuff that we've talked about with the ways in which we see him sharing like the lead with somebody, which we eventually get to see him do. Like this isn't new to us, right? Like the ways in which he's able to share the spotlight with not just female like co-stars, but other male co-stars. Like he's just damn good on screen with other people. He's so good at working with others. He chews scenery. What's the word? I actually wrote down a line. He chews scenery, but shares the meal. Is like Sandler to a T with these comedies, and that's not new to us. But I feel like a lot of people saw The Wedding Singer before. Like this was kind of their allowance was like, all right, it's been a couple of movies now. Everybody keeps telling me this guy's pretty funny, and this is supposed to be the cute one, so I'm gonna go see this one. Like, and people are just like, oh my god, like he can be subtle in moments. He can actually put character work in and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, that's what I've been trying to tell you.
Yeah, that's why I watch Billy Madison to go to sleep every night.
And they're like, should we watch Billy Madison? And you're like, no. That's not what I'm saying. You missed the point.
If you want to, but you don't feel required to.
Yeah. So you said I get to do old and
yes.
blue, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. I get to steal the easiest but best one for us to talk about is Alan Covert. like in terms of the old, like we get to see him finally give Covert like a good meaty character to be on screen, and it's awesome because he is just, his friendship with Sandler is so clear on screen, and the ways in which they are able to be so bro-y in this movie. And bro is not the right word, because it's exactly the opposite of that. I mean, the moment when he finds Robbie downstairs, when Sammy comes downstairs and finds Robbie just curled up in bed, sad, and he crawls in like Big Spoon next to him to like talk to him about it, and he's just like, it's downright cute. Like their friendship, it adds to that delightful factor that we talk about, and that eventually you get to see much more of with him and Drew Barrymore on screen. It's also present for there with him and Alan Covert, and it just speaks to the ways in which, as we've said so many times, he likes making movies with the people he likes being comfortable with, and so that's what he does, and that makes it such a delight to watch.
Very good, very good. Luckily, I saw that you were going to steal Alan Covert, and I picked some of my own things on this, and there's a lot of old in this one that it's like retroactively old with how we've looked at the universe, because honestly, I forgot that John Lovitz was in this movie singing Ladies Night, and that's just one more spoke to the hub that is Little Nicky with him as the peeper.
It is him as the creeper in the yeah. tree, right? Yeah.
So like, that's important, right? Singing in general, as much as there is that musical number in Billy Madison, it feels more like an homage to the big musical numbers of old Hollywood, and not, yeah. Oh yeah, Adam Sandler can sing too. He's not
this
just
movie,
a comedian.
Though, it's actually disappointing that they don't go the whole hog and just make this a musical for him, because man, the moments when he's singing, and it is him singing, are great. Like, yeah. Like even the moments, and to the musical factor, like it's not just I want to see him sing a bunch of old 80s songs that I love. To the musical thought, the character work that goes on when he does Love Stinks after the wedding, and the ways in which that entire scene and the music in it is so important, and the ways in which he then interacts with the people he just crapped all over. Brian Posehn, by the way, pretty sure at table 9 there.
Definitely. Yeah, he bites him.
Yeah, so there's all of this stuff that goes on in that moment that I was kind of disappointed that they didn't decide to just go full-on jukebox musical in the film for it. It actually made me want to go and see the stage show again because of me remembering how much more enjoyable some of the scenes are in this movie when the music is elevated.
I get that. But the singing, that's one. But the one that I really want to touch... Oh, it's Peter Dante's first film. This is where Peter Dante joins the fold. Nice. And that's cool, right? To see how he joined. And then in the next film, he's one of the bigger roles as the quarterback of the football team. So it's nice to see that, like, Adam Sandler, if he likes you and he notices what you're doing, you're going to get rewarded, right? That's what watching these movies has really shown, that, like, he's there and he's noticing the people who he wants to work with. But the big one for me is there's the cameo with Kevin Nealon, and that takes place in a setting from an SNL skit. So, like, has the hatchet been buried between him and Lorne as early as The Wedding Singer?
Oh, yeah, man. I got the funny feeling that as much as we can talk about the idea of there being Hollywood rivalries and the idea of him leaving SNL because he knew he was better than what they were treating him as, and obviously they were going to try and keep him there, but, you know, cheap and all that. Like at the end of the day, we have to remember that us talking about this stuff, and not just you and me, but the world talking about that sort of stuff, we always blow that crap up, right? Yeah. And the idea, especially with comedy, and especially comedy in this part of the world, is so incestuous. You know, like so it becomes this idea of him, like, being able to go back to SNL seems like, oh, it's an important part of his thing. And it is, but it's also kind of obviously what was going to happen. Because to that same point, I was actually just this past weekend watching Heavyweights, which is a Ben Stiller movie that is directed by our guy that ends up doing Little Nicky.
Steve Brill.
Steve Brill. It is directed and written by Steve Brill and Judd Apatow, by the way, which is another conversation.
Judd Apatow worked on this one, but I'm sure we'll get there.
Yeah, right. Like so. But the other big thing about it that I only remember, well, so the Ben Stiller, and then obviously the connection that you quickly make there is Christine Taylor, his eventual wife, years later being in this movie. But Alan Covert has, again, an amazingly kind of meaty role in that movie as the cameraman that ends up that Tony Perkis, played by Ben Stiller, ends up pissing off, and he ends up becoming integral to making the film that they use at the end of that movie. So he's like, he's got lines, he plays characters, he shows up in the penultimate scene when he's in the decathlon as one of the question askers and stuff like that. Like, so there's just all of this weird Alec Covert in my life right now. So, like, watching that and thinking about Stiller and thinking about this relationship, then thinking about Steve Brill and thinking about Judd Apatow, and eventually how both of them end up working with Sandler. And, like, there's all of this stuff that's going on right now in the 90s in this comedy scene that, like, and this was, to be honest, like, we've never really talked about it, but this was what was considered alt comedy in the 90s, because, like, the big wigs were the guys like Jim Carrey, who were able to make three movies in a year and stuff like that, like which, but these were the guys that were considered, like, the indie comedy movies.
And that's crazy when you consider Jim Carrey as the alt comedy, when the only reason he was able to do what he did was because SNL didn't want him. And then in Living Color was like, well, then you should come hang out with us.
Well, and so SNL kind of, in a weird way, anything that they kind of kick to the curb kind of enters that alt scene. They are kind of, and this is true of SNL in the 90s, they are kind of the arbiters of what is high comedy of this time. Like, that is, and then anything else that doesn't fit into that mold kind of becomes like, well, if you don't like this, or if you're not going to see Coneheads, if you're not going to see Wayne's World, if you're not going to go see Tommy Boy, then, like, you're not seeing the true comedic geniuses of our time. Meanwhile, you have guys like Sandler who were just like, nah, me and my friends are just going to go over here and make our movie then, and they succeed.
Yeah, and that's it, it's a completely different world.
Yeah,
God, in the 90s, something to be explored, and something we explore often. All right, so Blue, hit me with your Blue shot.
So the big thing that is in this movie that I think we haven't talked enough about yet, and maybe it's kind of indicative because of the way in which this movie treats them, is we need to talk about Alexis Arquette for a moment. Not because I think this movie does anything too damaging to Alexis. In fact, from what I understand, they enjoyed themselves so much in this movie. I mean, they eventually come back and reprise their role in a later Drew Barrymore, Adam Sandler movie blended. so, like, they come back and all that. But I think the biggest thing for me is the ways in which the few scenes that Alexis Arquette has in this movie, the ways in which they are treated are not celebrate. They're not celebratory, right? Like, they are always treated as kind of like the weirdo. And then at some point, this movie kind of just forgets about them. They do show up in a couple of scenes, but, like, they don't get any lines or anything like that. And it's just, it's a shame, because Alexis Arquette is actually a phenomenal actor. And they had so much going on at this point in the 90s that, like, casting them in this movie, was really cool, and like being on set, and as I said, clearly enjoying their time on set with Sandler and with Barrymore, to the point where they come back 10, 15 years later for Blended. Like, so it's just, it's a pity that character is not treated better. But that's honestly the bluest this movie gets, is there's a couple of moments in which Alexis Arquette, for anybody that doesn't know, I guess I should explain this. Alexis Arquette is one of the Arquette siblings, David Arquette and Patricia Arquette and all them. And they identified as male when they were really, really young, but at a very young age, they realized that they didn't quite fit into that mold for themselves. Whatever the acceptable terming is on that, they decided to become a female and presented as female all the way through the 90s and the early 2000s. The reason that I'm sticking to kind of they, them, and I'm going to try to anytime we talk about them, is that they did eventually later in their life start to realize that they didn't quite feel they felt female either. And so they went through a lot of like weird liminal space where they didn't realize what they identified as. And through all of that, like going through that journey, like became a huge advocate for LGBT people, for trans rights, for all of this great stuff. I mean, openly, Patricia Arquette and David Arquette have both spoken about how their relationship with Alexis is really kind of opened their eyes very early to a lot of these issues and why they've always been kind of leaders in that world. But they it's really interesting because Alexis touches so many people in kind of the circles we've already talked about. Because of David Arquette, they end up on a couple of episodes of Friends with Courtney Cox, which also touches Jennifer Aniston, which comes back around to Sandler. They end up in this movie with Sandler and all of them, right? They do all of this other work. So it's just a shame that at this point in their life and in their career, there was not more character work for them or celebration of the fact that they were in this movie.
It's strange because Alexis Arquette, like, knowing how you approach The Blue, right? Because we come at it from different directions.
Yes.
I figured that the George character would probably be where you landed, especially because, like you said, it's weirdly the most offensive part of this film. And even calling it offensive seems like I'm putting too much weight on it because, I mean, Alexis Arquette, the next year is in She's All That, playing the character Mitch, who is openly a male character in that film and has scenes, like topless scenes where he doesn't have a shirt on, right? Where Mitch is not wearing a shirt. So the question to me is the character of George is just a man who's effeminate, right? Like it.
Well,
it's
so,
hard
okay,
to determine
so George,
that.
Well. So the only real window we have into that, because again, the movie does not spend enough time on it, right? Like, is which I think you're kind of like pointing to when you ask that question. The only real window we have into that is the fact that they are clearly a representative homage reference to Boy George,
right?
And Boy George identifies, as at least to my understanding, identifies as male, but as you're saying, identifies as a male with female presenting attributes and like an effeminate attributes and all that sort of stuff. So if that is the window, right? If that is the only real way we're kind of going to get into this, then yeah, I can definitely I can agree with that. What I would say is, the movie doesn't do enough work to answer that question for you.
Right. And I think that's the most offensive thing about it. But also you need to consider, we don't really learn anything about the drummer, guitarist, or bass player that are in Robbie's wedding band.
No, but they also don't get cutaway gags at the wedding at the end.
True.
Where George is crying all over themselves, right? Like, so like, I agree, but this movie seems to want to make more out of George than it does, and then never does.
Right. And that's the thing. And also, I mean, Boy George loved the George character. Boy George loved the homage. He felt that it was handled very well. So then, like, knowing that that's what they're going off of and where Alexis Arquette was in their journey at the time, I've always kind of looked at it as it's just this like, sort of femme male figure.
Yeah. Well, and if you really want to get on like your deep thought conspiracy, like academic, like parsing of all of this, the fact in which they are treated in 1985, the ways in which they're treated, is definitely something to talk about. And the fact that doesn't ever stop Robbie from having them everywhere, like George is at every one of Robbie's gigs, and then on top of that, they are also at Robbie's wedding at the end. So clearly, Robbie cares about the character. I wanted him to just talk to them at some point. You know what I mean? Like, have a drink with them at the bar. Like, what is? Why is there no moment where we establish why Robbie hangs out with George as much as they do? You know, have a scene of like rehearsing at Robbie's house or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a missed opportunity, and I think that's the worst thing. And because it's a missed opportunity, because it just sort of presents, and it presents as this thing that like Robbie is clearly fine with this person who chooses to live their truth this way, right? Robbie does not have an issue with it, where I'm sure that Glenn would, right? I'm sure that Glenn would have a comment here or there. It unfortunately becomes a more offensive moment in the film when you consider things like Steve Buscemi's drunk character in the very beginning of this film, which, how did Adam Sandler get Steve Buscemi to be in a movie? Like, can we talk about it? Thanks, Steve Buscemi, for being in Hubie Halloween and really kicking off this whole adventure, right? A million thank yous. My last
note, by the way, Mr. Buscemi, because I know you're listening, my last note is nice bookend. Nice bookend.
It's a beautiful bookend.
But
it's one of those, like, so that we're like, well, she's a looker, right? Like, that's the one where it, like, sort of angles into that, like, more offensive, because we're not given any more about the character.
And if
the character would find that offensive, we just see it as the sort of 90s gay panic type humor being injected into this 80s environment.
Yeah, there's this little like part of me, I don't know if it's an evil one or a good one, that is like, well, at least they didn't turn the character into like a horrible stereotype, which would have been like the other hard swing in the other direction. But it's that conversation we've had 1,000 times on both here and the Say Report, is like, is it more offensive to present a character and then have them go hard and have people be like, well, that's a little too hard for my liking, or to not have them at all, right? And it's like they try and find this weird middle ground where this character is present the entire time but then never like address them, and it's just, it feels weird. It just comes across as weird.
And even in those small moments that George gets to have in this film, there is something just really impressive to the fact that, you know, Robbie gets to take a break, right? And that's fair. He is afforded one, let's say, 4-minute break where George sings "Do You Really Want to Hurt Me" by Culture Club, really just clenching the whole Boy George of it all, right?
Well, right, yeah. The ways in which George represents that side of music. I mean, like, Robbie mentions The Cure by name later on, but like clearly in that vein, right? So George also serves a phenomenal purpose in terms of referencing the era and the music, as we've mentioned earlier. Yeah, sorry.
No, I appreciate it. So like, that's the thing. And then that when like Robbie gets held up at the first wedding because he's talking to Julia, and clearly George singing "Do You Really Want to Hurt Me" went over like a lead balloon, right? At that first wedding, nobody was really feeling it. Still knowing that they have to stretch for time until Robbie is ready to perform again, he just has the band play it again.
Yeah.
And there's that brilliant throwaway line after Sammy comes out to be like, they're starting to turn on George, man. And he goes, yeah, he really needs to learn another song. Like, it's not just because nobody liked this, but I want to give it another shot, right? Which is kind of how it looks that first time. It's literally George's only weapon in their arsenal is "Do You Really Want to Hurt Me" by the Culture Club.
Because that's just the way that their set is set up, right?
Yeah.
Like, I love it. It's such a look into Robbie's business, too, and the fact that, like, well, and I think it's really interesting because the other thing that's really important about Robbie, right, like his whole character story this entire time, is that he isn't being forced to change, right? Like he's doing fine, and then once something like his fiance leaving him at the altar kind of hits him like a ton of bricks, and he realizes that he needs to make a change in his life. He needs to start either taking this career that he has and making it meaningful, or find something else. And it's a beautiful window into the fact that of how little like he had been putting into this. This isn't a band that could go play anywhere else. They literally are set up to just play parties. They just have a set that can cover a couple of hours with some great moments built in for audience interaction, and boom, that's it. The fact that George has not learned another song is indicative of a lot.
Yeah, and it also really shows a lot of attention to detail about what a wedding band is.
Yes.
Right? They're not necessarily a band. They're an act that goes mm-hmm. and performs at your wedding for 3 hours.
That and you're supposed to love while you're there
yeah.
and forget years later. Like, you're yeah. not supposed to think about the wedding singer after the wedding.
Right. They're supposed to fade into the background because it's not about them. It's about mm-hmm. the bride and groom.
And it's why Robbie, I think, chooses that particular musical career path, is because it allows him to still do his art the way he wants, but never forces him into a spotlight.
Yeah, which is very strange considering all of those moments where he has to improvise to, like, fix tiny fires everywhere. Like Steve Buscemi's Dave being too drunk. Or the sad kid at the bar mitzvah, right?
The sad kid at the bar mitzvah scene is still one of my favorite scenes.
Let me tell you, though, that kid ate a whole cake in Matilda, and that kid loves cake. Quotation marks. Euphemism.
There's something about, like, there's going to be people that watch that scene or are a little squishy about, like, the whole, like, 13-year-old grabbing Drew Barrymore's butt stuff and things like that. And, like, I can get that. There's something about the naivety and the innocence of that scene that is just so, it hits so good for me as a kid that grew up in that era in the 90s and seeing that kind of stuff. You know, you joke about him being in Matilda, but like, you know, I would have also seen Matilda a couple years previously, right? Or, you know, I dropped Heavyweights earlier, and there's the phenomenal dance scene in that. And one of the things I never noticed before, but I did this time around, is the party ends, the lights come up, everybody leaves, and in the crowd, you see one of the characters that you've been following all along. They make no effort to zoom in on or anything, but he lands a deep kiss on the girl that he had been dancing with. And it's an amazing little character moment that you're just like, oh yeah. And you know, it's a couple of 13-year-olds kissing at a dance, and it feels weird as a 30-year-old man now, like, watching it. But I'm just like, yeah, man, like, you get you some.
The squishier thing about the bar mitzvah scene, right, is that Adam Sandler takes that little girl's hands and puts them down on his buttocks.
Yeah, no.
Like, there's the really squishy thing. Really, the kid in his innocence of, like, going to grab a butt because today you are a man, my son. Like, I get that. Like, you kind of get that. And that was the type of humor that we saw a lot in the 90s. What does it mean to be a man in the eyes of you know, your faith as opposed to society? So it's interesting, but then what clinches that scene and what clears it up is that the entire dance floor, from the youngest person to the oldest person, is doing that butt-clenching dance move.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just really kind of shows that there are some things that unite us all.
Yeah, I will take the stance of, because we watched a young boy do it to a girl, seeing sailors suffer the same fate later is only a quality to me. But
it would be one thing if the girl did it. It's the fact that Robbie takes her hands and moves them down, where I'm just like, oh, 2021, that's a problem. That's a problematic moment.
The other thing that I will point out, and maybe this should have been my new, but I don't think it, this is the first time that we see, and not the last, but this is definitely the first time that we see Sandler and his crew really push in the Jewishness to his movies.
No, that's true.
Yeah, it's hinted at in the earlier films, I think, with just, like, jokes that they make and words that they use. But this is the first time that we see a straight-up bar mitzvah scene, and he sings in Hebrew. And it's amazing. It's
also the first, I should have mentioned this as well, there's just so much that this film does because of the whole entry-level nature of it. This is the first mention of the last name Lamonsoff, right?
Yeah.
And we've already seen that with the Wonder Kid in Pixels. And if we continue down this path, we're going to run into a couple more Lamonsoffs. There's a Lamonsoff in Murder Mystery.
Mm-hmm.
He uses it as his alias. So, yeah. So I guess I'll do my blue, and then we can move on to, you know, the meat of this. We've done a lot of meat. We've had a lot of appetizers and aperitifs with this particular film, which is, you know, it's because we're talking about wedding stuff, right? There are hors d'oeuvres. There are people with trays. My blue is Robbie's suit in the opening, which is actually really interesting when we consider that so often we're trying to establish Adam Sandler as this blue-collar character. So again, and a lot of that comes through in the closing choices that they put him in when we're first introduced to him, or in something like Just Go With It, where you have to be like, I know he's a doctor, but like, he's not that kind of doctor.
Right? So he wears
he's
jeans,
a fun doctor.
Yeah. like a Patch Adams? No,
not like a
Patch Adams.
Not like a little more fun than Patch Adams, right?
Oh, take that. Shots fired.
Dude, there's a murder in Patch Adams that ruins Patch Adams every time I watch it. I'm having fun. He makes the vagina entry for the gynecological society. And then a woman gets straight up murdered. And it's just like, well, now I'm not having fun with Patch Adams anymore. That's why the Robin Williams cinematic universe, we will leave that for someone else to explore. Because a lot of those movies, it's a lot of fun until somebody inexplicably dies or gets murdered.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But yeah, so it's that suit. But it's interesting because I don't necessarily think that wedding singer is a white or blue collar job.
Of the musical world, like I will argue that in the world of musical talent, and this kind of goes to what I was saying before about being able to remain hidden, it is probably the most blue collar you can get, because you are working consistently, you're never outshining anybody, you're not ever going to go more beyond your contract, right? Like he's literally working at the same venue every time, right? Like and the ways in which he can interact with other people on his level is really important for blue collar workers too, right? And so the idea that he can go into the photographer's place and talk to them as somebody that's worked with them before, right, is really important. So yeah, on the one hand, it's not your normal everyday blue collar job. In a lot of ways, it kind of feeds into that beautiful trope that I love from romantic comedies of the 80s and 90s, where the guy always has a ridiculous job. Usually it's just like, I'm an architect, but only for like large buildings in New York. What? it's kind of in that same vein, right? And it is weird. But if you were going to tell me that he was still a blue collar worker in this movie, I could get down with that because of the fact that he is a consistently working wedding singer.
Yeah. Which I'm going to jump into the deeper discussion now of that fact that he's like a blue collar worker and all of that. Something that's not really explored a lot in this film is how, and again, and this is weird and it's going to support my finding on this one, which I think at this point I can say, I think this is in the universe. I honestly think I could put this into our Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And I'd love to hear your argument for or against that. But the fact of the matter is, Robbie Hart fits in with Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore in just the most absurd way. And yes, it's because they're all orphaned in some way, right? Billy Madison loses his mom, so he's raised by his father, and he has that arrested development from the third grade. Happy Gilmore loses his parents, moves in with his grandmother, has that arrested development of that time when that happened in his life. And then you get to Robbie Hart, and again, his sister straight up says it, ever since our parents died when he was in the third grade, all he's wanted is to get married and start a family, right? So, like, that's why money doesn't really mean anything to Robbie Hart, why he's willing to do like the singing lessons to Ellen Dow's character, Rosie, and he's willing to get paid in meatballs because he's happier just making people happy and sharing his gifts with people. And then it becomes a really big through line to this film that he's happy and he feels fulfilled, but like that's not attractive to people. People are not going to find you attractive or want to marry you just because you're the fun guy.
Well, and there is one hole in his life, and he thinks it's that he needs to be married. He thinks that he wants to start a family and all of that stuff. But I think what's important is that he realizes that what he really wants is he wants to grow up. And to him, you know, getting married and having a family is growing up. And it's not that when he realizes that he has to work on himself that he suddenly gives up on his dreams of getting married and having a family. That is still part of it. But he recognizes that that can't be it. If he had gotten married, if the wedding had worked out in the beginning, he would not be happy. He'd realize that that was not what he really wanted, and that could have been extremely damaging, because he would have finally gotten what he wanted and realized it wasn't what he wanted. That could break a man, right? So in a lot of ways, he turns out to be very lucky that that doesn't happen, which is often the case in these stories. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's this element to him that he is as successful as he chooses to be, but there's something that's just not clicking for him. And he thinks, like, the turn in this movie is he's kind of led to believe that what's missing from his life is money and success and business and things like that. But we then, you know, we know that that's not the case, and he learns at the end that that's not the case for sure. So just to kill the suspense here, I definitely think this is in this movie, right? Like, I feel like this is in the universe. This movie is in the universe. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I don't know. But the idea
you were so excited. I get it.
Yeah, no, but the idea being that he fits in very perfectly with these characters. We have all these beautiful story beats that happen, the ways in which all of these people are involved. The family element is clearly on display there. Have we made it a rule? The more offensive term would be the man-child-esque characters, but I think really the bigger thing is the stunted maturity of his characters is, I think, something that's really important for the universe, is that his character is always stunted at some point in their life, and they don't ever mature beyond that specific point, right? And if we have not made that a rule already, I'm introducing it as a new one now. But that idea that, as you mentioned with Billy, the fact that he loses his mom and he gets stuck at that level, or with Happy losing his family, or even later on in other movies that we've looked at, with Nikki being kind of like weirdly not able to grow up past that like teenage phase as well, right? And so
mm-hmm.
important factor for Sandler characters in the Sandlerverse, and Robbie's got it all over.
Yeah, I agree. And it does. I don't know if it's actually a hard and fast rule, but I am fine with putting it to a vote and adding it as one, because it is a huge part of these characters that we're seeing. And it's why something like Pixels fits into the universe, because of Brenner being stuck in that one time where he lost.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and then Hubie, like, yeah. I mean, clearly being stunted in his maturity for sure. Yeah, I think it's just that right there kind of starts the wheels turning, and then everything that we've mentioned so far about the ways in which this film is handled and all of that it fits too nicely into this universe for us to ignore it. I think it has to be there. There's no direct references to a heaven or hell, but also this world is so silly that if something like that did happen, it wouldn't ruin the movie by introducing the idea of magic, right? And romantic comedies always have that little bit of magic in them, right? Like, not to sound like too big of a cheese ball, but like that idea that these two people are lucky that they met each other when they did, or else, you know, like real things could have screwed up their lives, is that's part and parcel. That is in the DNA of the romantic comedy.
I mean, Billy Idol, who sings White Wedding and is on the current issue of Rolling Stone, just happens to be on the plane.
And time traveled back 20 years. Yeah. 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah. No,
exactly. Right. There's these little moments of magical realism throughout the film that are, I mean, did I miss the part? And okay, so like, we always say spoilers for these things, but like, I'm going to talk about the end since we brought up Billy Idol here. Was there any hint that they were on the same plane until it's revealed that they're on the same plane? Because if so, I missed it.
No, I mean, so one of the things I did the second time I rewatched this film was do a plane transition counter, because they love using the plane wipe to let it know. And no, it's not until it's revealed that the guy in coach said, "I'm grade A choice, you know, product," right? He thinks he's Don Johnson. Mm-hmm. And Robbie looks back. We don't have it confirmed, but it's kind of hard not to believe that they're on the same flight, based upon, like, they haven't left before he gets to the airport. Like,
fair enough. Yeah.
like there was never a doubt in my mind that they were on the same plane. So
I never thought about it. It just didn't even occur to me that that could be what was going on, you know?
Mm-hmm. I get that.
Yeah, so when they revealed it, like, I was just like, oh, shit, snap. Like, that was the what that was for me, that reveal that they're on the same plane, and then he goes back and plays the guitar for her and all of that. That 10 minutes is pure romantic comedy gold that is ingeniously like inventive. Like it is, there's no, that's not like that was the moment where it really hit home how little this movie borrowed from other movies on like other things that we've seen him do. Because man, they could have done the top of the Empire State Building, right? Like they could have gone all out with this movie and done something ridiculous like rowing a boat under the stars or some nonsense, right? But no, like they invent whole hog a beautiful moment that I swear I've seen 1,000 times and could not point to a single time I've seen it.
I mean, and that's the important thing about this early romantic comedy phase in Hollywood is you want to make sure that you're blazing your own trail. And that airplane moment, right? That moment on the airplane where he sings, "I want to grow old with you," and everything that happens there is one of those iconic moments. It's so iconic that like, that's before the rewatching for the show. That's what I remembered about this movie.
Yeah.
Like that's it. That and Love Stinks. But that's because I'm a huge fan of the Jay Giles Band. And I was so happy that they were featured in this movie when I was younger.
All of that and Rapping Granny, which honestly was not as much in this movie as I seem to remember her being in this movie.
Well, because she was in all the marketing. So
right,
you
right.
saw it in literally every bit of marketing for this film is yeah. Ellen Dow, who lived to be 101. Just a fun fact.
Worked for another decade or so after this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's her doing the Sugar Hill Gang song. I can't think of the Rapper's Delight.
Yeah.
And it's literally, it's less than like 30 seconds mm-hmm. on screen of her doing it. But it kicks ass. She nails it.
After and, nailing the other song that they've been yeah. working on the whole time.
Which in, the Music Man, we should give some yeah. credit to the Music Man. Because mm-hmm. like, that's a good deep pull for like Adam Sandler's love of cinema. Right.
Yeah, cinema like, and yeah. Yeah, man. So we have not talked nearly enough about Drew Barrymore in this movie, as she is so on par like with Sandler in this film. Like she's great. She hits every second that she's there. She is there just as much as he is. And I want to point out specifically one of the other things that I really, really enjoy about this film is the ways in which their relationship really truly is believable. Like the workplace romance that it starts out as to the development of their friendship and eventual like relationship, there's never a moment where I feel like they skipped a beat, where they jumped too far ahead. And that is done in no small part by the chemistry between Barrymore and Sandler in this film. They just, any moment and any feeling they're supposed to have with each other is so genuine. Even the moments when they're not supposed to be in love, like earlier in the movie when Robbie is just feeling like shit because he's been dumped and Julia is just trying to comfort him outside. And she's like, you know, I kind of was hoping you wouldn't quit because I was hoping you'd play at my wedding. That feels like a genuine thing. Like it's not her being sneaky, trying to spend more time with him. It like she seems to really enjoy him and really wants him to be there. And like, and his reaction of just like, I don't know if I can keep doing weddings right now, is not coming from any type of creepy place of like, I love you and I can't let that go. Like it is a legitimate feeling that he's having. It's just, it was really, really cool to see the ways in which their friendship felt real and the eventual love between them because of the friendship earlier in the film works for me.
Yeah, this is one of those films where I talk about how romantic comedies kind of ruined an entire generation for like how love works, right? And really, if we're going to blame one person, it's Meg Ryan's character in Sleepless in Seattle. She would be my genesis point of that. Because as Rosie O'Donnell says in that film, you don't want real love, you want a movie. And then we proceeded to create an entire genre that was people getting their movie.
Or as Nerf Herder once said, what you want is Mr. Spock. yeah, that idea that, and I will point to Meg Ryan, not just in Sleepless, but also in When Harry Met Sally. Because if you're not looking for that magical moment of meeting the man of your dreams and instantly falling in love, you're then having that moment of I've been best friends with you for years and we know everything about each other. Why are we not just getting married? Which is the other side of that coin.
Right. So it's all Meg Ryan's fault, really. But that's for another podcast at another time.
Hopefully, if you're listening, you understand we're just kidding because you're the best.
You're delightful. We're gonna celebrate you and your appearance in Joe versus the Volcano very soon, on the Say Report. It drops on Mondays. But it is this love story, right? In terms of the types of love stories, it feels so genuine. It feels so genuine that I felt bad when I was taking my notes watching it, being like, they've only known each other for like 3 months, right? How believable is it? How believable is it that these two are actually going to grow old together? And I'm like, what an asshole. Why would you ask that question? Why are you wondering about the what happens after happily ever after? But like, it's because of the cynicism that romantic comedies has like instilled in me, because that's not how it works in the real world.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this truth to their like cute falling in love at first sight, but not acting on it immediately. It's not we fell in love, we went home, and we slept together, and now we're dealing with the consequences of that. Like they spend more time together, not as a couple, and they eventually come to realize that they do like each other, but they never make any move to ruin the other person's life. It's never until the realization that, hey, that person's life is kind of ruined already. Like maybe I could step in and actually help this person. That's when they make their move. You know, there's never a moment where they're gross towards each other, which is, I think, the simplest way of putting it. Is too many romantic comedies depend on a moment of just like skeeviness on somebody's part in the relationship for us to ever feel truly comfortable with the relationship. And I don't know if there's a moment of that in this. I don't think I'm, you know, somebody could point something out to me, and I don't want to be wrong, but like I don't see one. I don't see that weird moment in this
I'll actually
story.
Prove your point by saying a major factor in all romantic comedies is the breakup, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where
mm-hmm.
like these people have been so close to each other, and it has to come to I let them go, and then I realize what my life is like without them, right?
Yeah.
And in almost every other romantic comedy, if you named a romantic comedy, I could point to the party that is at fault between the two leads, right? But
right.
with The Wedding Singer, the party that is at fault is Holly Sullivan, Julia's cousin. Because she is the one who says to him, she is marrying Glenn for the financial stability. For all of those things that actually matter to people that you will never be able to provide to somebody.
Yeah, and she says it, but she says it genuinely.
Yeah,
it's not mean. It's not cold-hearted. It's not malicious in any way. Like she's like, you know, this that that's why they would go through with something like this. And I actually wrote in my notes that both Holly's cousin, I mean, sorry, Julia's cousin Holly and her mother both have these moments where they kind of. They draw a line and they say like, look, like you, I know that you're feeling weird about this, or I know he seems like a weird dude, but and I'm speaking about,
Glenn
here. I wanted to call him Gavin again. I'm talking about Glenn here is like, they're like, but like, you know, you have talked for a long time about how you love being with him and he has money and he's handsome and he does a lot of these things. Well, like all of the information that we have to this point is telling us that this is the right thing for you to do. And here you are feeling squishy a couple of days before the wedding. Like, you know, maybe that's just feelings. It's not like they know that he's a sleazeball and they're like, but just deal with it. That's not at all. That's not the story, right? Like, because in that moment that you're talking about with Holly, she's not saying that because she's not saying that with the knowledge that Glenn's an asshole. Like, we know that. And Robbie knows that. But like he doesn't tell her what just happened that night, and I think that that's also another really interesting part is he doesn't use his knowledge about Glenn in any gross way to try and steal, you know, Julia away. And in fact, he tries to give Glenn like every chance that night at the bar to get out of it. Like when he first realizes that Glenn is admitting to cheating, the next thing he says is, but you're going to stop doing that now that you're getting married. Right. And then that is when Glenn's like, why would I? And you know, I'm parsing words here, but that's essentially the conversation. That is the subtext, right?
Well, it's actually that conversation is something I wanted to focus in on, even if just for a minute. Because Glenn's whole thing is like, I've gotten, about 10 days ago, I got with a lady who was hotter and younger than that woman you say I'm too old to score with right now. And then he's like, really, how do you get away with it? And he's like, Julia's preoccupied with the wedding, right? So, like, right. Not that Glenn Gulia is worthy of any sort of redemption at all, but, like, that's almost written as this thing where, like, I'm going to marry this girl, and right now I have this opportunity to sow my wild oats and get that out of my system, so I'm taking advantage of it. And it's like, I mean, that's still not great based on Hollywood morality or any morality that exists, but they present it in this way where, like, oh, okay, I get it, right? He's just trying to do it so that he can be a better husband to Julia. And then he says, so when you get married, that's going to stop. And he's like, nah, I work in the city and I work late, if you know what I mean. And it's just like, then why the fucking trappings, you asshole? Like, it just, it, up to that point, there's really no reason to outwardly hate him, right? Like,
he gets slowly worse.
Yeah.
He says a couple of things, he does a couple of things, and you're just like, ugh, you're gross. And you know that you're not supposed to like him because he's going to end up being the Baxter in this whole thing. He's going to get left on the side, right? Like, you know that that's coming. But you're right. Like, it isn't until that moment where it hits home how gross he is. And then at that point on, he's just gross for the rest of the movie. Because it's also after that with the fight scene in the alley, too, dude, with the old man.
The DeLorean thing, like, don't puke in the car. It'll smell for a week. No, she's clearly sick. Like, she don't need that. She don't need a lecture.
The worst in that moment, and it's just the worst for the rest of the movie.
Yeah. You're not wrong. It's, But it's interesting in terms of the construction of that character and the script that, like, they kind of give him that little bit of redemption, too, to just be like, ah, no, we've tricked you. He's a piece of shit. He's always been a piece of shit. Right. Why?
Well, and, you know, you could even say up to that point, the idea of sleeping around and we're, you know, we're just dating. We're not married, like that mentality. Like, there's a lot that is often forgiven, and more than we rightly should. But a lot that is often forgiven by saying it was the 80s. Right. Like,
right.
So, like, that idea that if they didn't lay the law down and say, like, no, this dude plans on being an asshole for the rest of his life. If they didn't establish that, then you'd be left with that question. Of was he really that bad? Because, like, he was just doing what guys of that time were doing. And yes, he leaned towards the worst kind of guys at that time. But, you know, the second that he's just like, no, I'm going to continue being a dick. Don't worry. It's just like, okay.
Yeah. Well, right, I mean, yeah, because they give him all these beautiful things like, ah, she's putting her time, right? I got to get married eventually. And, like, that's not the reason to marry somebody, right? Like, like, this movie has this real great view on, like, love, in terms of love should be the thing. Like, a lot of the ways that our society has said we should get together might be fucking broken. And I give it a lot of credit for that. Like, it's awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the made family concept kind of blown out, man. Like, it's the idea that, like, you should only have people in your life that you care about. You shouldn't have people in your life because the rest of the world says you're required to have a wife, you're required to have kids, you're required to have a best friend, you should just have people around you that just are the people that you care about. And, I mean, it even speaks to the relationship that I talked about earlier on with Sammy and Robbie, right? And the ways in which, like, their relationship together in the 80s is not one that you would usually find for two men on screen, right? And so seeing that is really cool too. Like, the movie all around just has a lot of love for a lot of the people in it, even the people that are not necessarily always right. And that goes back to, like, to Julia's mom and Holly and stuff like that. Is like, Holly ends up becoming a phenomenal character by the end. Like, it's just, she definitely has her moments where she makes the wrong move, but it's because she doesn't have all the facts, so it's completely understandable.
Right. But also, I mean, in that moment, she is putting her ideals onto Julia and why she's willing to go out there. I mean, the character of Holly Sullivan, there's some real beauty to, like, a sexually forward female character in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's not ashamed of the fact that she sleeps around. It's a choice that she's making and she's happy about it, right? Because that's where she feels she is in her life.
Well, again, it was the 80s. Like, yeah. Sexual liberation was still kind of in the water. We were learning a lot about the downsides of it at this point, but, like, it was still there, yeah. Right? Like, and the other characters that we haven't talked too much about, but honestly, I also really love, are Robbie's sister and her husband, who have a couple of beautiful scenes in this movie, and they clearly care about Robbie, and Robbie clearly is part of their family and is loved by them, and oh, man, that wedding scene in the beginning and the breakup, the leaving at the altar scene, which we funnily enough noted was not present in Just Go With It, was just absent. And like, was it that they just didn't think they could like handle writing that and make it still work in the movie? This movie blew that theory out of the water, because like the way that it's handled in this movie is perfect. His sister shows up. She cares very like deeply about the words that she uses. Like she thinks about and chooses the words that she uses to talk to him about it. And he tempers his emotions and then goes off screen to react. Like there's a lot going on in that scene. And again, like they have some kind of conservative style views in like, and not necessarily conservative in like the ways in which people should love one another, but in the comedy of their relationship is very old school, like honeymooners style, like, nah, one day, you know, the sexiness goes, but the love is still there. That attitude is kind of present in them. And like, this movie questions that, like whether that should be the case or not, but it never says that they're wrong. It just says like, maybe that isn't the way it has to be.
Yeah. It has a lot to say on that. And I will still say, Just Go With It. You can't show it. You can't show the left at the altar scene, because you show Adam Sandler being the one standing there alone, right, with an absentee partner. You feel for Adam Sandler. But when he's the one who's like, yeah, I lied to you this whole movie. Like, literally nothing from my mouth has been the truth, and I'm in love with my assistant. He becomes an immediate asshole. And you can't have that if he's going to be...
into a corner in a way. It writes them into a corner in a way in which they felt they just couldn't show that scene. Right. But as we pointed out, that's a reason. That's not an excuse.
Exactly.
Like it doesn't forgive that scene being absent from that movie. It's just why that scene is absent from that movie.
Right. But it's also one of the reasons why Just Go With It isn't part of our cinematic universe, because if Adam Sandler's characters are the moral center of the humor and story, that very much changes his character, even as a tell don't show moment. You're a dick. Like, sorry, Mr. Maccabee. Dr. Maccabee. But yeah, no, it's I like this film a lot, and but to go back to the original point, which I feel was 100 years ago, it's not their like breakup moment where they go away from each other. It really doesn't come from something that one did to the other, right? Yeah. Like she sees it's her conversation where he's like, I have to go make some money. There's money to be made and I want to get some of it. And she's like, that's kind of selfish. Like, that's the moment where we realize, oh, these two are made for each other, right? Because clearly she doesn't care that he doesn't have millions of dollars, right? She cares about him on a deeper level than the material. And that's what he needs and what she needs. So like, you idiots, why is there 20 more minutes to this film, right? What more are you going to do to us?
Yeah. And he realizes that that's not what she cares about, too, once he realizes what she was bringing in. Yeah. And it's a killer moment. And yeah, I one of the things that I also really like about this movie, and it's probably kind of my last real big note on it, is there's it's not a true unity of time and place and all that sort of nonsense. Like, it doesn't happen within 24 hours, as French law would state it to be. But the idea that, like, it all makes sense, the amount of time it takes for things to happen. He screws up with Julia, realizes he wants to say sorry that night, goes to say that sorry that night, and has his other moment of stupidity where he doesn't just say something. He assumes from looking through a window what's going on. And then, like, it's the next day that he goes after her, right? Like, there's this beautiful marriage of moments in this movie that make it totally believable that this is the next thing that would happen. There's never like 3 weeks where they don't talk to each other. There's never this idea that like, oh, for somehow he was, singing at a wedding at 10 o'clock at night, got on a plane, and then ends the wedding at 10:30 at night or something. You know, like it all makes sense. Everything that happens in this movie works, like, in a ways in which a lot of romantic comedies, especially after this one, like, don't always. Like, you can point out, like, weird, like, flubs in the ways in which, like, why is this a month later? Why is it suddenly Christmas? What is going on?
It's Christmas, so we can market it at Christmas, Wonder Woman 84.
And call it a Christmas movie, yeah. Despite the fact that only the last 10 minutes of this movie takes place at Christmas. Yeah.
So the marriage, her wedding to Glenn Gulia is going to take place on August 5th, 1985, right? Mm-hmm. That's like a big thing. That blow up between them happens on August 3rd, 1985.
Right.
It is the Friday before the wedding, because the Thursday before the wedding, August 2nd, 1985, is when Holly and Robbie go on the double date with Glenn and Julia.
Mm-hmm. And August 4th is the finale of this movie.
And August 4th, because she decides we're just going to fly to Vegas and damn the wedding that we have planned on the 5th. So, like, it's the craziest thing about this movie is that, like, they talk about we have 3 months until the wedding. There's so much to do. And then that 3 months is done in montage. And then the last 30 minutes of this film takes place over the course of a week.
Well, and to the point where they never force their love between one another. It means that they have been developing this friendship for 3 months before they ever get to the point where they talk to each other in this way, right? Like, it's great, because, like, I can't really put my finger on why the romantic comedy formula that you see nowadays, where they meet each other, they sleep together, and then they develop the relationship, is just not necessarily like I don't love that. And I think it's probably because every relationship in my life has always been one that's been built on spending at least some time together first, even if it was just a few weeks or something. At least it was a couple of days of getting to know each other before we realized that we liked each other. And that just feels so much more real to me. And so, like, it's just another beautiful thing about this movie is that the timing of it alone.
Yeah. I mean, it really says something that this movie doesn't become the Wedding Singer that I think about and that most people think about until the last 30 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
And that is when he realizes that Julia left her jacket in the back of the limousine. And then he's like, oh, you got a little crush on her. And, like, honestly, we know that that's where the film's going, right? Because either we've seen the film or the marketing of the film betrayed that to us, right?
It's the two of them looking lovingly at each other on the poster, right? Exactly.
But the love story is not introduced until there is 30 minutes left in this film. And then it is whirlwind. Like, in some ways, this feels like 4 episodes of a sitcom that would air in the 80s.
Yeah, that they weren't sure they were going to get a 5th.
Yeah. It's like one of those, because 24 minutes is the length of an episode in the 80s. And it's 96 minutes long. And so there you go. It's right there. It's all there. Like, you want to talk about, they borrowed the format of something like a Cheers and the Will They or Won't They. Of, like, we both got stuff going on, and then ultimately we realize that we should be with each other. And they pack it all into one package, one little movie, and it works. It just flat out works. It's
I would have preferred a Moonlighting reference, but I'll give it to you. Cheers.
Cheers is my favorite show of all time.
So what you got, Deb? What as far as, like, leftovers bits?
I mean, I really do just want to talk about fuck this movie, right? I've just lavished praise upon this movie for an hour and 51 minutes, and I have to say fuck this movie. I have to reference, and we'll go into it deeper, when I saw Blended in theaters, right? After the movie, tears still in my eyes and tears still in Dale's eyes, we looked at each other and said, that was a stupid movie. And that has become a sort of, like, shorthand between us of, like, I loved that movie, but I'm mad at that fucking movie for this reaction that I'm having.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And The Wedding Singer has not one, not two, but 3 just fuck out ugly crying moments in it. and to the fact that sitting alone after watching The Wedding Singer again for the first time in 23 years, I'm like, this stupid movie. And the first heartbreaking moment is when Robbie is walking to tell Julia that, I mean, like, I was honestly at the beginning of this going to put a bet on whether or not I cry during this episode, right? Because I've been getting really emotional when I'm recording lately, because we're just talking about emotional moving moments. And when he realizes, oh my God, I love her, I have to tell her that I love her. And we see him walking up to it and like practicing what he's going to say. And he looks up and he sees Drew Barrymore in the window wearing her wedding dress, so happy. And like to him, that's like, oh man, she really loves this guy. Like, fuck my feelings, right? I can't mess with her life, not knowing that the only reason she's so happy in that moment is because she's imagining being married to him.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. Crumble. I just fucking crumble like Apple
it's
Brown
true
Betty.
Irony. It is pure dramatic irony in its best form. Yeah.
And then the next morning, right, where she's like, damn it, I need to go tell him that I love him, that like, this is how I feel. And she knocks on the door and fucking Linda answers the door. Like, I know that Linda's there because the movie showed me that Linda's there. But in that moment, I'm so empathetic to Julia Sullivan that my heart breaks again.
Yeah.
Into smaller pieces.
Yep.
And then, I mean, like, these are the heartbreaking moments, but then my heart is warmed up and smelted and repaired stronger than it was before I went through this movie. And it is when on the airplane, he sings her, I Want to Grow Old With You.
Yeah.
And like,
with Billy Idol's guitar.
Yeah. And it's not just that, like, he finally gets to tell her and she finally gets to tell him how they feel about each other, but it is also this moment that, like, he can be the person that he wants to be, his truest self with her, because he kind of wants to be a songwriter. And then here's like this first song that really fucking means something, to the point that there's like a throwaway line from Billy Idol. Like, I'm going to talk to the record executives. You're probably going to be a famous songwriter going forward, Mr. Hart. Are you okay with that?
It's a true comedy. It's like, everything works out great in the end. Yeah. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a true Shakespearean comedy, right? There's a wedding, and everybody gets everything. The only thing we're missing is Chris Farley making out with a penguin. But I think that's because he was in Beverly Hills with a ninja, or possibly following Lewis and Clark. I'm not sure in the timeline. But, like, those are the big ones. Those are the things that, like, yeah, this movie works on so many levels. And it is firmly in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. Even if just the fact that the truest Adam Sandler cinematic universe is from Billy Madison to Little Nicky. And then everything else is going to maybe or maybe not fit into that. And that's a bold claim, bold statement here, but like I didn't realize how essential The Wedding Singer was until I rewatched The Wedding Singer.
Yeah, no, I am really glad that we watched this. I'm surprised that we didn't find our way to it in our first six, but I am happy that we did get to it and that we can so easily and so firmly say that it fits in, because I think it adds a lot, and at least as you reiterated earlier, like, it introduces a lot of the stuff we've already talked about in past episodes. It's too good to be true from top to bottom.
Yeah. I mean, we would have watched it in our first six if instead of Julia Sullivan, her name were Vera Vonnegut. But no, they didn't go with the double V in this one. So we don't cling to it until our ninth episode of the entire adventure and our third of our second season. But it's there, and it really is going to affect the way I look at the cinematic universe that you and I are cultivating going forward. So, like, this is an important one. It's not as important as Little Nicky. Little Nicky will forever be the hub.
Still the linchpin.
And the nexus. It's the linchpin. And I think it always will be. But this is the first movie where I can see the villain, Glenn Gulia, definitely sitting there with Eric and plotting against the Adam Sandler characters. He's there. He's in the room.
Oh, yeah.
And he's still referencing Miami Vice.
Oh, man.
So I guess the only thing, the only other, like, final thing that we do need to do is you put to it that Adam Sandler's character being stunted in some way, stunted maturity as a law and canon of our universe. I mean, it's just the two of us, so we vote on it. But I think it should definitely become an official law going forward.
Yeah, I honestly, again, it's another one of those things where I'm surprised that we didn't pick up on it sooner. But yeah, the idea being that there is something that stops him from being able to quote unquote grow up. And like I said, it can definitely lead to very fair criticism, but maybe harshly worded criticism about the idea of like the celebration of the man child in Hollywood, and about how that kind of that trope is not a healthy one, and it has its problems. And as we see for Sandler, like, becomes kind of problematic in later films, especially as he gets older. But I do think that it is key to the Sandler like oeuvre that be a part of the character.
Well, and it really, I mean, one of the main reasons why I'm like, I have a chisel in the stone out right now is because the last two films that we watched, Just Go With It and Murder Mystery, he's not that. And very easily, we can look at those and say, these are not part of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah.
Despite clear shared ideas and references between them, the fact that he's kind of a fully formed human being, it makes it hard for me to believe that these are all happening in the same world. And that's something, right? Even Just Go With It, where him being left at the altar by his girlfriend, finding out the truth about his girlfriend and fiance, like, he still moves past it.
It doesn't stunt his maturity at like a young age, or like a, like he is in that movie a grown, successful human being that just chooses to just be the worst kind of human being.
It's very different. It changes his path.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop him from moving and growing. But I would be very interested to see the Just Go With Me where he becomes stunted in that moment at 18 and still is going to do. I don't remember what his specialty was going to be beforehand, but then he switched. He was going to be a heart surgeon, and then he switched over to plastic surgery, you know, like you do when your heart's been broken. I kid, of course. All right, so I think this is good. Anything else that you want to add before we send this one out to the listeners?
No, enjoy it. I mean, the soundtrack is still fire. Like, go check that out, especially if you can get a hold of any of, like, Sandler doing the songs in the movie. A lot of the times with this, it's an inspired by soundtrack, so you get the original versions, which is also amazing. But if you can get a hold of Sandler doing any of the covers in this movie or his own stuff, it's all good.
I mean, and also, I mean, as much as you want to celebrate Sandler in this one, what really shines in this film for me is John Lovett singing Ladies Night, but more importantly, Steve Buscemi singing True by Spada Ballet.
That's true, yeah.
And also the Don't Stop Believing for Strings that plays at his wedding.
At the wedding, right?
This is a good movie. It's a movie that truly understands music. It's fire. It's everything. It's fantastic. All right, so next month on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we will be continuing our time with Adam and Drew and looking at 50 First Dates. So that's something to prepare for. Go watch this movie. Even if you're just listening to this, it's out there. Right now it's available on HBO Max, and The Wedding Singer is definitely still worth your time. And if you watch it and you disagree with us, then you can tweet at us at the ASCU. And you can also, if you enjoyed us here, you can find us on the Say Report. That's wherever podcasts are found, and the new episodes of that are dropping every Monday. And if you would like to tell me why I am such a fool for squandering my opportunity to be in a musical adaptation of The Wedding Singer, I can be reached directly at Devin D. Decker on Twitter.
And if you have any of your own covers of 80s hits that you want to play at my wedding, you can find me at Siege Versus the World.
All right. And until next time, remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.
I wanna make you smile when you're sad, and carry you around when your arthritis is bad. All I want to do is grow old with you. I'll get you medicine when your tummy aches, and light you a fire when our furnace breaks. Oh, it could be nice to grow old with you. Well, miss you, I'll kiss you, I'll give you my coat when you are cold. Oh, I need you, I'll feed you, I'll even let you hold the remote control. Well, let me do the dishes in our kitchen sink. I'll put you to bed when you drink. Oh, I'd like to be the one who grows old with you. Well, I could be the one who grows old.